From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. The music of folk rocker Josh Ritter. Ritter's on his way to the top. Some critics have even deemed him the successor to the greatest songwriters of our time.
Of course, I use some of these templates that I grew up with, you know, some of the people like Dylan or Springsteen, and I look up to them in some ways for what they've done, you know. But they're all my songs.
Today, the lure of the lights, the sound of the music. We'll get inside the life of the tribute band, Sticky Fingers.
We're sitting in a frat house at the end of a show. There's sort of spilt beer all over the floor and college co-eds making out on the stairwell. And he just sort of turned to me and he said, "What happened to me? You know, I was supposed to be a rock star."
Of course, sometimes the music is enough. It is for one former Juilliard student who made his home on the streets of L.A.
I drive home, you know, wrung out from another day at the office, and I'd pass Nathaniel. And he'd be on the streets, in the 2nd Street tunnel, sitting on a milk crate, playing the cello with his eyes closed and his head back, and it was a picture of pure ecstasy.
The band known as Sticky Fingers bills itself as the leading international Rolling Stones tribute show. The guys in the band look and sometimes act the part on and off stage. Since the Broadway musical Beatlemania, tribute bands like Sticky Fingers are here to stay. Stephen Kuritz writes about the phenomenon in a book called Like a Rolling Stone. He told Steve Paulson how he met the lead singer of Sticky Fingers.
I picked a few bands, and one of the bands was Sticky Fingers, and I met this guy, Glenn Carroll. I went up to his house in Massachusetts, and the experience of meeting him, he lived in this big house. He had a beautiful girlfriend. There were pictures on the wall of him with various, you know, 70s-era classic rockers like Edgar Winter and Rick Derringer. It was like meeting a rock star that you just never heard of. And so I really became fascinated with him as a character and with his life as sort of a, you know, a pretend rock star.
And he's the stand-in for Mick Jagger.
Yes, he's the stand-in for Mick Jagger, exactly.
And how far does he take that imitation?
Well, you know, he takes it pretty far. Certainly on stage, he has all the clothes and he has the football pants and the knee pads that Mick wore on the 81 tour. And the scarves and the Omega t-shirt that Mick wore on the 69 tour. And then in his own life, there are times when he occasionally sort of subconsciously dips into a Cockney accent. So it can, you know, there are, he definitely approaches his role methodically.
Hmm. Well, you write about how when you first started following Sticky Fingers, they had a new Keith who the other band members were very excited about. They called him the Keithiest of them all.
Yes. Yes, the Keithiest Keith. And he certainly was the Keithiest Keith. In a little over a year that I spent with the band, I saw him out of his Keith wardrobe once. And it was sort of a shock to see him in standard dress. But, you know, I would pick him up for shows 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning on a street corner in Manhattan, and he'd already be dressed like Keith Richards. He really took his role seriously. And he almost seemed more comfortable as Keith and in the Keith clothing. And he has great charisma. Somehow I sort of describe him as a superhero in civilian dress when he was out of his – he was sort of deflated somehow.
What do you make of these guys who devote their lives to impersonating famous rock stars?
Well, you know, I'm very sympathetic to the tribute performers. I don't think I could have written the book had I not been. You know, they really wanted to be, most of these guys, they didn't set out to be Keith or Mick in Sticky Fingers. They set out to be rock stars. They set out to be the next Mick and Keith. And, you know, it just didn't happen. And the odds of that are so ridiculous that this was sort of the next best thing.
Can these guys make a living doing this?
There's a certain echelon, I would say maybe 10%, that are sort of the top-tier tribute bands, and absolutely they're making a living at it. I mean, Glenn Carroll has been Mick Jagger since around 1989, 1990, as a living, full time. I mean, that's his job. And the other band that I followed, the Blushing Brides, they go back to 1978, and they had done it for a living. And there's a band, a Grateful Dead band, called Dark Star Orchestra, and they gross over $1 million a year. They have their own tour bus, their own merch man, their own manager and booking agent. They sell CDs. They play in soft seat theaters. So for the upper echelon of tribute bands, you can make a living at it. The majority of them are guys who have day jobs and are weekend rock stars.
Of course, it helps for the Grateful Dead tribute band that the Grateful Dead is no longer around. I mean, Rolling Stones are still out there. They still perform. Are they aware of these tribute bands?
I think they're probably alternately weirded out and flattered. There was this moment, it was a wonderful moment where the Rolling Stones were playing this big arena in Charlotte, and literally a block and a half away, Sticky Fingers was playing the pre-concert party at Dixie's Tavern in Charlotte, North Carolina. And I sat there, and there were helicopters sort of flying around and big lights going on for the Stones. And if you closed your eyes, you could mistake all the fuss for Sticky Fingers, And I sort of wondered if Mick Jagger and Keith Richards would sort of stroll over the block and a half from the arena to Dixie's Tavern and watch the proxies of themselves on stage. It didn't happen, but I sort of fantasized that it would.
Now, you clearly have a lot of affection for these tribute bands, especially for Sticky Fingers. You hung out with the group a lot. But was there also a part of you that felt kind of, I don't know, sad about this? That somehow these people were, I don't want to say delusional, but they'd kind of wasted their life in some ways?
Well, I like lovable losers. That's often who I find myself writing about. So I did find it sad, but I didn't find – it wasn't depressing to me that it was sad. But there is sort of a melancholy aspect to these guys. I can think of a couple examples. One of the guys in Sticky Fingers who was really charismatic and, did sort of have a rock star vibe to him. He was in his late 30s, or he is in his late 30s. He lived in a little house on the Jersey Shore that he was sharing with somebody. He drove sort of a beat-up old car, and he had done it so long that at that point he was sort of unwilling or unable, really, to go straight and get sort of a regular day job. So he's playing in these cover bands, and at one moment in the book, we're sitting in a frat house at the end of a show, and of course there's sort of spilt beer all over the floor and college co-eds making out on the stairwell. And he just sort of turned to me and he said, "What happened to me? I was supposed to be a rock star." And, it just sort of hit home that it wasn't – being in Sticky Fingers was fun, but it was for him somewhat of an empty calorie that, or even a reinforcement – each time he did those gigs that he hadn't fulfilled his dreams.
Hmm. In some ways, if they do play a big concert, now that was very unusual, but in front of 11,000 people, probably
right.
Their experience was not that different from the Rolling Stones themselves. I mean, if you want to try to get a little philosophical about this, I guess I wonder if even the Stones sometimes have to try to be the Stones. I mean, there's an image of the Stones in some ideal sense. And I mean, every time Mick Jagger and Keith Richards go out there, they sort of have to live up to that.
You're absolutely right. There's a point where if you've been a band long enough, you sort of become a tribute of yourself. If you've seen one Stone show, you've seen them all. There are all these little cues that happen, like Keith Richards does a little set and the crowd sort of yells Keith affectionately and he stumbles up to the microphone, as if he is half drunk. And Mick is going to sashay around and move his hips and they're going to play Satisfaction. And they are, in a sense, a tribute show to themselves. And the other thing is, like, let's say you go see Leonard Skinner. Well, three or four of the guys in the original Leonard Skinner are dead. And you're seeing 3/7 of the original Leonard Skinner, and really, what's the difference between seeing 3/7 of Lynyrd Skynyrd and seeing like a really smoking Lynyrd Skynyrd tribute band? I think the difference is sort of negligible, really.
Now, on the other hand, there were some big concerts that the Sticky Fingers had. You say that once they played in front of 11,000 people in Rotterdam.
They did. And the next night, Bruce Springsteen played the same arena, which gives you a sense of the ups and downs of a tribute band. I mean, you could be at a frat house, you know, one weekend, and you can be flown to Rotterdam and picked up in a limo and playing in a packed arena the next. And that was a high for all of them. I mean, that was an amazing experience. They had, you know, a professional sound crew and a pyro show. And, you know, they got to experience really what it was like to be a rock star in a real way, not in sort of the low-rent version. You know, and the other thing I'll just sort of say on this point is that the thing I admired in Glenn Carroll, the sort of the driving engine of Sticky Fingers and the Mick, was that by sheer persistence, he had carved out a small little corner of himself in rock and roll history. I mean, here he is, now he's on the cover of a book. There are sort of 20 years worth of frat kids who seeing Sticky Fingers is sort of a big part of their college experience. And Glenn has played with, he shared the stage with classic rockers like Alice Cooper and Foreigner. So in some way, even though it's sort of second best, and even though he probably would have rather been the next Mick Jagger and not a Mick Jagger clone, he has carved out a little spot for himself in the music world.
Stephen Kuritz is a journalist and author of the book Like a Rolling Stone, The Strange Life of a Tribute Band. Christopher O'Reilly is a classical pianist who plays to huge crowds wherever he goes. But aside from his classical pedigree, O'Reilly's made a name for himself covering the rock music of his own time, like the melancholy songs of singer-songwriter Elliott Smith.
I'll fake it through the day somehow, Johnny Walker Red.
Smith hit the big time with the song Miss Misery, which was used in the film Good Will Hunting and nominated for an Oscar. He died young, at age 34, under mysterious circumstances, although the death was officially deemed a suicide. O'Reilly transcribed Smith's songs on the album Home to Oblivion. He says he remembers the first time he heard Smith's music.
It was really an immediate reaction, similar to that which I had when I heard Radiohead's OK Computer for the first time, or the Messian Quartet for the End of Time, a couple of other pieces, Apollo by Stravinsky. Just, you know, where has this piece been all my life, and, you know, how much more is there? And so I set out to learn all I could about the then recently deceased Elliott Smith. So Speed Trials was the first song I heard. Ever since that moment, I set out to find all of the recorded material, whether released commercially or otherwise. And so as a result, I now have virtually, I think probably about 100 Elliott Smith concerts on my iPod, and virtually everything that he released or intended to release during his lifetime.
With an Elliott Smith, part of what you listen to in his songs is that eerie quality to his voice.
Yeah.
It's just, I suppose eerie might fit, but sad?
Well, I think there's an acknowledgement. I think with all great literature, I mean, I think I have to start anyway from my Irish roots and say that there has to be an acknowledgement of the wide variety of experience or the possibilities of extreme happiness as well as extreme melancholy. And I think those are rife throughout Elliott Smith's songs. I mean, Between the Bars is a very good example also, not only of happiness and great sadness coexisting, but really a sense of irony and a sense of ambiguity that
well, it's this question
really,
about what he meant.
Yeah, and he never really spoke about what he meant and was somebody who really appreciated those who didn't talk about what they meant but just, you know, did the work. I mean, people like Samuel Beckett, you know, figured very prominently in his reading list. And
So with this one, you could jump in and say, sure. Between the bars, yeah. is pretty clearly a man grabbing the bars in front of him in an asylum.
Could be that, or could be, you know, drink up baby, stay up all night. You know, it's a couple of people just, like, you know, stumbling from one bar to another on a pub crawl. Yeah. Or, yeah, as you say, grabbing the bars of an asylum or an overnight, you know, drunk tank, a jail cell of some sort or another.
Do you think about those things? Because you've done some study of Elliot Smith. You, mm-hmm. you said you came to him after his death, mm-hmm. so mm-hmm. you didn't have a chance to talk about this with him. Mm-hmm. But you've delved pretty deeply into what you can find out about who he was.
Well, I know his family pretty well now, and so I've been able to ask his father and his stepmother, you know, various questions, and still have, you know, so much that I have yet to talk to them about. I mean, it's an extremely sad situation. I mean, his father is in a situation where he really just can't listen to his son's music. You know, it causes him such enormous pain. It's really quite sad, and they were very, very close, and he and I are of the same mind that I don't think Elliot Smith took his own life, but, you know, that's kind of where things lie as far as the LAPD is concerned. But anyway, I mean, yeah, there have been lots of talks about lyrics and the way that he would write and how they would come to him, but I think the thing that makes Elliot an extraordinarily special songwriter, and particularly as a lyricist, is exactly that acknowledgement of the huge compass, the huge range of emotional life within a song.
Drink up, baby, stay up all night with the things you could do. You won't, but you might. The potential you'll be that you'll never see. The promises you'll only make.
I'm curious about some of the pieces. Maybe we can talk about just a few of the ones that you actually have made transcriptions of. You start your album with Coast to Coast. Mm-hmm. You want to tell me about that one?
Yeah, it's an amazing song because it starts out really vestigially. I mean, it's almost like wisps of guitar recorded noises. I mean, there's a lot of somewhat aleatoric and somewhat, you know, early electronic music kinds of aspects to some of his later work. I mean, a lot of it wasn't released, but a lot of it really is a lot of little tape loops and very funny things like that. And so it starts out, and you can hear this sort of keening, somewhat frenzied will-o'-the-wisp sort of thing. And then you do hear the whoosh of a soundproof door as if he were entering the studio, and then the drums kick in, and actually the drums are, I think, triple tracked. It sounds more like a marching band. It's just the most huge sort of sound that he gets. It really is one of his most frightening songs, and yet at the same time, when he comes to the chorus, it really sounds more like a jingle than anything else within this context of true fear and desperation. You know, it's really a monolithic song. It's an onslaught. It's a juggernaut, and that kind of feeling, you know, beginning a record album as it ended up being the first record on From a Basement on the Hill. I just found it inescapable as far as trying to make a piano version of it.
All of that in your head, you obviously wanted to make the piano version of it, but finding all of those elements and putting them into your two hands and your 88 keys has got to be hard.
It's very hard, and I end up doing a lot of things that are counterproductive to being able to play them on the piano, because there's quite a lot of noise generated, and so there are things in my left hand part that really are more noise than notes, and it's, you know, it's a matter of getting the cusp of that quite right, so you've got at least the information of the bass line as well as a sense of the onslaught of these triple track drums and that kind of sense of things. So it's really a question of trying to get what you can out of the piano to make it work. I really found a lot of things along the way were very helpful from the Thelonious Monk playbook, for instance, in particular dealing with the vocal line, because even with the best of intentions, people like Franz Liszt would transcribe a Schumann song or a Schubert song for piano solo, and it was basically, you know, one finger plunking out the melody. Yeah. And with Thelonious Monk and people like that, there are more clusters, there was more after the sound of between the bars, between the keys, as it were, and more looking for the saxophone kind of effect.
This brings us back to who Elliott Smith was. And in mm-hmm. some ways, even though you never had the opportunity to meet him, you mm-hmm. know him as well as anyone mm-hmm. does now. You've spent time with his family. You've listened to hundreds of hours of his music. You say you don't think he killed himself, that LAPD mm-hmm. does. But there doesn't seem to be any question that he was a very troubled
man. Very troubled character, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And in his music, there is that strain of melancholy, even mm-hmm. when it approaches happiness, mm-hmm. that's there.
Yeah.
Is that the way into his music, do you think? Is that the strain of melancholy that all of us feel to some extent?
I think, I mean, you know, if you're Irish, you're prone to that kind of thing. And yeah, there are lots of folks who, you know, hear him for the first time and think, oh, it's just too depressing, I can't be bothered. But I feel, you know, I keep going back to this, it's the range of expression. It's not necessarily the autobiographical aspect of it, but the acknowledgement that, you know, as Butters says in his famous episode in South Park, you know, he's lost his girlfriend, who was no one more to him than a waitress at a restaurant who was pretending to pay attention to him, and yet he's taken it very hard. And he said, well, if I hadn't felt so good before, I wouldn't feel so bad now. And so I have to realize that, you know, it's gonna come around again, and that I acknowledge that I will feel that good again. I might feel this bad again too, but I would hate to cut out any of that experience.
Pianist Christopher O'Reilly on the life and music of the late Elliott Smith. O'Reilly's tribute to Smith's music is called Home to Oblivion. Coming up, a schizophrenic musician finds redemption in the arms of music. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Rockers are notoriously difficult. Just ask To the Best of Our Knowledge producer Doug Gordon, who sat down with two members of indie band Sloan, Chris Murphy and Patrick Pentland, with Suppose They Close the Door.
2, 3, 4.
Hey, you shed your reputation. Now deny your compensation.
Are you serious?
What? That was you. That wasn't me.
You can't.
Doesn't it go?
I wrote it. Since when do you tell me how to play my own song?
But that's. I've always played it that way.
Patrick, I could sit on my ass in Palm Springs for the rest of my life, and I don't have to come down and teach you how to play.
I make more money.
Listen, I don't want to say it. I make twice as much money as you, basically. You make part of my music royalties, and basically that's about it.
An eye for an eye is no way to get even.
What are you doing?
You think that fair is square.
Just
you're
don't
going even, too
don't
fast. Even don't even play. Don't even play.
I can't see the chord.
Because you don't know the chords.
Well, if you turn around, let me see the bloody chords, and I'd know what the hell you're playing.
I'll write them out for you. I wrote them out last time, and you didn't bring them, basically, is why the only reason... What is that? What chord is that?
It's a B minor.
What chord is that?
Is it not B minor?
It's an E flat minor. What? That's not even in the song. You are out of the band, my friend. I swear to God, I'm calling Jay right now.
I can't work like this.
What, you don't think we can do it without you and your little metalhead songs?
I'd like to see you try.
Oh, yeah, I'd like to see you try. Oh, yeah, Patrick Pentland, live at the Roxy. Ha, ha, ha. I'm so sure. Yeah, I'll see you next year. You'll be opening for
us. You'll be looking for me on another label.
I'll be signing you up to my label, Murder Records, which you don't even own. You don't even own part of it. You are out. Consider yourself cut off, basically.
This is how you want to do it. Right here, like this.
Good night.
Thanks for dropping by, guys.
Doug Gordon tried to interview two members of the indie band Sloan. Sometimes the urge to create music is so powerful it overwhelms the desire for money or fame. Sometimes the music is enough. That's what LA Times columnist Steve Lopez found in a homeless musician named Nathaniel Ayers. Lopez wrote about Ayers in the book The Soloist. He told Dan Strangchamps about the first time he set eyes on Nathaniel Ayers.
I heard beautiful music, and I turned and saw a striking image, kind of a strange image. A man playing a violin that appeared to have been pulled out of a dumpster. It was so scratched up, and it was missing two strings. Yet the music was quite nice, I thought. And this gentleman was standing next to a shopping cart that appeared to contain all of his belongings. So I'm thinking, okay, this guy must have a story, and maybe that's my next column. The other thing that was interesting was that I looked, and he did not have a hat out. He was not playing for money. And I walked across the street and introduced myself, and he jumps back, very wary of me. And I thought, okay, this one may take a while. And I said, why do you play in this particular spot? It's, you know, really busy and noisy. And he points and says, there is the Beethoven statue, and I play here for inspiration. Mm-hmm. And I went back on several occasions, and each time I visited Nathaniel Anthony Ayers, who told me that he had grown up in Cleveland, I learned a little bit more about his story. And one day he had scratched some names on the pavement, and I asked who those people were, Betty and Tom and whoever, and he said, oh, those were my classmates at Juilliard. And I just paused. I said, excuse me, you went to the Juilliard School for the Performing Arts? He said, oh, yeah, that was quite a while ago, and all I'm doing now is trying to get back on track. And I said, well, are you aware that a violin has four strings, not two? And he said, yeah, that's my whole goal in life, is to figure out how to get those two strings. And I said, well, I'll buy you the strings. And he said, oh, no, no, I couldn't cover that, and I'm not interested in any handouts. So I ran back to my office and checked it all out, and sure enough, he'd been at Juilliard. In fact, he was there with Yo-Yo Ma for a time. He went not to play violin, but he was playing string bass at the time. And I wrote this first column without anticipating the reaction.
So what is it like to have a conversation with Nathaniel Ayers?
Well, he's a very sick man.
He has what, schizophrenia?
He was diagnosed with schizophrenia in his third year at Juilliard, early 70s. And, you know, he was treated for many years, but the treatment was like from the dark ages. It was some pretty heavy-duty stuff, including Thorazine, which just, you know, sapped any creative instinct. So he has rebelled against that and doesn't want to hear about medication and doesn't want to believe that, you know, it's a different generation of meds. And, you know, he's been in handcuffs
for
vagrancy.
He's had shock treatments, right?
Shock treatments. And so when you talk treatment with Nathaniel, he gets very nervous and, you know, very angry. And so talking to him, depending on what day it is, you never know what you're going to get. And it's taken a lot of patience.
Yeah. So readers, I know, had an incredible reaction to your first column, and people began to call you up and say they'd like to send Nathaniel instruments. They'd like to send him violins. A guy who runs a music company called and said he was sending him a cello. Somebody said she'd like to give him a piano. This was extraordinary. And at that point, I guess you decided, I'm not ready to let this guy go. I want to have some kind of relationship. I want to see if I can help him somehow. But that turned out to be pretty hard, right?
It was, and it is. We're 3 years into this now. What readers saw, though, was this story of second chances and, you know, human connections. And they sent the strings that he was missing and the violins. They sent violins that they dug out of their attics and closets and sent these wonderful notes saying, you know, I'd played years ago and always thought I would return to the music, but I don't know when I will, and I'd rather that Nathaniel have these. And I sort of got trapped because when I took the instruments to show him how much people cared about him, he said, well, all right, I'll take them now. You know, at first he said he couldn't pay for them, so he couldn't take them. And I said, no, no. These are fellow musicians who are making sort of a donation to a brother in music. And he said, well, okay. And then I thought, I can't leave these with him. It's like painting a bullseye on his back. He's living on the streets, sleeping on Skid Row, where he might be mugged for these things. So that's when I had to break all of the rules of, you know, keeping your distance and not getting personally involved. I felt like I was responsible for his welfare at that point. And that's when I made a connection with the mental health agency and became determined to try to get him off the street.
You tracked down his teacher, actually, his old teacher at Juilliard, right? What did he remember about him?
I found two teachers at Juilliard and the one in Cleveland who was a member of the Cleveland Orchestra for many years. And they all describe a kid with great talent who had a terrific sound on his instrument. And he was able to transfer that to violin and to cello. So his playing is not polished, and it sometimes is schizophrenic. It breaks up. It's bits and pieces. It's the equivalent of stream of consciousness. But he gets a great sound out of it and moments of brilliance. And the beautiful thing to watch is that as he gets into it, he looks about as happy as any person could be. And he had me thinking about, what is success? What is happiness? I drive home, you know, wrung out from another day at the office and battling this battle and, you know, rushing home in time to kiss my daughter goodnight and maybe do battle with the health insurance company that had denied a claim and just feeling, you know, just kind of wrung out. And I'd pass Nathaniel and he'd be on the streets in the 2nd Street tunnel, sitting on a milk crate, playing the cello with his eyes closed and his head back, and it was a picture of pure ecstasy. And I began to think about, you know, how many people find that kind of a passion in life? I became envious of it. And it's one of the many rewards that I've had in this relationship is to be introduced to the power of art in a way that I had never been before.
Some of the most beautiful passages in your book involve meetings that you set up for Nathaniel with professional musicians. There were some cellists, violinists with the LA Philharmonic who really wrote to you and said they couldn't just let the story drop. They wanted to volunteer to teach him, to help him. And then, I mean, tell me something about the relationships that you watched develop between professional musicians and this street person.
It was a big turning point in this whole story when I wrote about my night with Nathaniel on Skid Row and wrote that he had sticks on which he had written Beethoven and Brahms, and he used those to chase rats away. And he went to sleep dreaming about symphonies. I got a call from the L.A. Philharmonic, and they invited us to a concert, and Nathaniel didn't want to go because he said people shouldn't have to pay good money to see great music and be in the company of a street person. And I called the orchestra back and said, hey, how about if we come to a rehearsal? And Adam Crane, the publicist, who's also a cellist, said that would be fine. So we went, and we go to Disney Hall, and the closer we get, the mellower he gets. And it comes into view, and he says, Disney Hall looks like an iron butterfly. And Itzhak Perlman is molten lava on violin. And he goes from this scatterbrained, angry man to this mellow, you know, patron of the arts. And we get in, and Adam Crane, the publicist, gives us a tour, and it's as if Nathaniel has been sedated. This chemical change came over him. He was charming. He was witty. It was as if he was back home. And some of the musicians came out and met him, including Peter Snyder and Ben Hong, who are cellists, and struck up a relationship. And it was Peter who offered to give him lessons. And at this point, Lamp Community was holding an apartment open for Nathaniel, thinking he might be ready to move in off the streets, and Peter agreed to give him lessons in the apartment in the hope that he'd get comfortable and want to live there, and it worked. And when it did, we were all just so thrilled for him and proud of him, and these relationships have remained. It's as if they've accepted him as one of their own, and that just means everything to him.
At the end of your book, in the acknowledgments, you thank Nathaniel, you say something like, for allowing you to enter his world. And it struck me that, you know, the whole way through, that's kind of, there are two halves of this story. I mean, part of what happened is you opened a door for Nathaniel. You let him enter back into the world of functioning people that we all live in. And the other half is Nathaniel opened a door for you as well, and he let you into his world. What do you think you learned there?
Well, the obvious things are I learned a little bit about music. I learned patience, which I don't think too many columnists have. But, Yes, one of the many rewards was and gifts from Nathaniel was him letting me know him well enough to tell his story. And it's a story that has had an impact on public policy discussions and has humanized not just Nathaniel, but I'd like to think thousands in the process, and helped to destigmatize mental illness. And the giving that this relationship has involved has been a real force in my life. I was never a big brother type. And an act of human kindness delivers you, it seems, to a state of grace. I'm not a religious person necessarily, but I feel connected to some force through Nathaniel. And I so envied his passion, and he reminded me that I had my own, and that maybe I had let it slip away a little bit because of the turmoil in the newspaper industry. I was kind of down on things, but I have the privilege of dropping into people's lives and getting to know them and sharing stories that might move people or make them think. And I just realized through Nathaniel that that's my passion, that's my love, and it means as much to me as music does to him, and that probably has been the greatest reward. He just reminded me that my purpose is to tell stories.
And Strange Hands talked with Steve Lopez, columnist for the LA Times and author of The Soloist. Here's Nathaniel Ayers. Coming up, the life, times, and music of folk rocker Josh Ritter. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Josh Ritter has arrived. After years playing open mics in Boston, then establishing a name in Ireland, Ritter has finally found his niche in America. The folk rocker has sometimes been dubbed the heir apparent to Bob Dylan and Bruce Springsteen, and Joan Baez has recorded a version of his song Wings. Ritter's latest album is called The Historical Conquests of Josh Ritter. He stopped by the TT Book Studios to talk with Steve Paulson and play a couple of songs like this one, Temptation of Adam.
If this was the Cold War, we could keep each other warm. I said on the first occasion that I met Marie, we were crawling through the hatch that was the missile silo door, and I don't think that she really thought that much of me. I never had to learn to love her like I learned to love the bomb. She just came along and started to ignore me. But as we waited for the big one, I started singing her my songs. I think she started feeling something for me. We passed the time with crosswords that she thought to bring inside. What five letters spell apocalypse, she asked me.
I was sitting in my basement. I had just bought a house in my hometown in Moscow, Idaho. And I was sitting in my basement. I had moved a desk down there. And I think the subterranean sort of feel of it made me think about being in a missile silo. I write a bunch of different ways, and I try and be open to writing and ideas wherever they come from. And sometimes they just kind of spring into your head, kind of fully formed. And the idea of falling in love in a missile silo with a girl and trying to keep your mind on, you know, the fate of the world while kind of falling in love with this girl sitting next to you in a jumpsuit was the puzzle, you know, and I thought, like, that'd be fun. But I was really thinking about, like, the you know,
Do you really have to think about the end of the world? I mean, do you sort of have to get into that mindset? Well, or is it more thinking about love?
I was more thinking about love, you know. The end of the world part was for the comedy. But I thought, like, you know, like, really, you can have the story of the Garden of Eden without having to have God involved, you know. It's about, you know, that first flush of love when everything seems perfect and before you really know everything about each other. And that's the moment where it's kind of like, you know, after that, it's as you learn and as the knowledge comes along, you know, things get more complicated. And maybe that Garden of Eden existence is kind of lost to you in some ways. In other ways, I think it continues. But I like the idea of love in the most controlled environment, you know. Like a kind of hothouse flower or an aquarium or a missile silo, you know.
Oh, Marie, if you would stay, then we could stick pins in the map of all the places where you thought that love would be found. But I would only need one pin to show where my love's at, in a top secret location 300 feet under the ground. Oh, we could hold each other close. We'd stay up every night, looking up into the dark like it's the night sky. Pretend this giant missile is an old oak tree instead, and we'd carve our name in hearts until the war hit. Well, Marie, there's something tells me things just won't work out above, that our love would live a half-life on the surface. So at night while you are sleeping, I hold you closer just because, as our time grows short, I get a little nervous. So I think about the big one, WWIII. Would we ever really care if the world had ended? And you could hold me here forever, like you're holding me tonight. I think about that great big button, and I'm tempted.
Now, is this new album a departure for you? I mean, were you just doing something new here?
I think, yeah. I kind of want every album to be... Every album has to have its own language, musically and lyrically. It has to... And I never know what that is, except that I base mostly what I... You know, I learn things from recording each album, each subsequent album. I try and take lessons I learned and kind of turn them on their head and go in a different direction because... It keeps it interesting for me, you know.
So what did you do differently this time?
Well, I wrote, my last record, Animal Years, was about kind of religion and the war in America and how we talked about it. That was, for me, it was like a big, huge topic, and it was kind of political, but also very, like, you know, it was a very heady mix of stuff. And I just didn't want to do that this time. I wanted there to be a lot of humor. I wanted every song to have something funny in it. As much as I could, you know. You know, I didn't want to talk about big subjects. I wanted to kind of let, if there were big subjects around, which there were, you know, the war, for instance, I wanted them to come in on a very, very oblique way. So that was one thing. I also wanted to write on piano. I wanted to get away from guitar, and I just wanted to kind of pound on piano, which I really can only play in C and A minor. It's like, I can only play the white keys, you know, and so I was just pounding away like, you know, I guess like Frankenstein's monster, you know, just all 10 fingers on the keyboard and very slowly.
All of a sudden now you're back again. I thought you were happy with whoever. Did you dream about me now and then? Did you look up at the stars and feel something for the constellations?
So you were actually doing the music first before you wrote that?
A lot of times. The music and the lyrical ideas kind of come separately. And I think it's kind of like you're finding the frame of a crossword puzzle, the musical frame, and then you fill it in. You know, sometimes you get lucky and you find the right clue, you know. Well, you know, a certain idea won't fit with a certain type of music, and you just have to hold them in your head or in your little book for years sometimes before they all kind of fit together. And when they do, it's just completely magical, you know. But I think mostly it's about like waiting around, you know. And I had to wait around to find the right language for this record, and it's very much like I was listening to a lot of Buddy Holly, like early Buddy Holly, like apartment tapes that he did where it's just him on his own, and then lots of like Paul McCartney, the Ram record, which is great, and then a lot of rap.
So it sounds like you're intrigued by the circumstances in which music is made. I mean, it's obviously you got to like the music.
Definitely.
But it's sort of where that music comes out of, too.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. My parents are both scientists, and I thought I was going to be a scientist, a neuroscience, and I thought that was it for me. But what I found as I studied was that I was way more interested in the scientists themselves, you know. Mm-hmm. I was way more interested in somebody like Newton and what the time he was living in and how he went about doing the things he did and these amazing things and dangerous things, how he lived through some of his own experiments. And I was way more interested in that necessarily than the results of the process, you know, which is weird.
Yeah. I thought I heard you pulling up outside. It's just the wind whistling through the pines. I haven't seen the one I'm looking for. Just empty shadows in my open door.
Well, I'm so struck by how you harken back to some of these great musicians from the 50s and 60s, Paul McCartney, Buddy mm-hmm. Holly, and I mean, you can hear a bit of Dylan in, mm-hmm. in your music, of Springsteen, and you know, you've said you're 31 years old. Mm-hmm. I find it fascinating, right? And I'm intrigued by how someone of your age goes back to music back then. I mean, sort of whether you feel like, I mean, is it just appreciating the music then, or is there, do you have to kind of jump across generations and think about the different world that they were living in?
Well, I think music of any kind that's made with some honesty, you can recognize it. You know, you can, I think, honesty, I don't know what exactly honesty is, but I can tell when somebody, you know, when somebody saw that, you know, fish swimming by and reached in and grabbed it, you know, you can tell. You know, you can tell when they latched onto something. And I think I appreciate that. I mean, there are people like, you know, Leonard Cohen or, you know, of course, Dylan, Tom Waits. There are these artists, but there are also people like Alfred Deller, who is an amazing countertenor, or Marian Anderson, or people like, you know, Sonny Terry. Or, you know, there's these people that, you know, it could be anything, and you would recognize it when you heard it as something that was special and apart from everything.
Well, let me ask you about Dylan, because that's maybe the musician who most often pops up when people talk about your influences, and certainly some of your songs, I'm thinking of To the Dogs or Whoever, where there's just this flurry of words. They just kind of come pouring out, which is rather Dylan-esque.
Totally,
How do you think about his music? What makes him special?
Well, I mean, Dylan is like, you know, you have to think about Dylan a lot of different ways, especially writing. Anybody who's a songwriter is I don't think it's especially special to be compared to Dylan. Everybody is, you know, everybody with a guitar. I take it as a huge compliment. You have to remember that Dylan is like a historical figure. You know, he comes from a historical, the set of circumstances that created him and that he created are impossible to unravel. And, you know, in terms of anybody being a new Dylan, it's an impossibility because Dylan was Dylan.
Some people of your age are resentful of that time. It's like, can people just shut up about the 60s?
Well, I think, you know, that there's three things that never really change in art and in writing. If you take apart any song, it's about war or love or God. And those things have never changed. And in different degrees, it's all about, for me, writing about those things. And the themes never change. And people, I don't really believe people change. So I think it's about, you know, I love a lot of music from that period. I love a lot of writing from that period. It's an incredible period. But this is my time. And I'm writing about what I see around me. And of course, I use some of these templates that I grew up with, you know, some of the people like Dylan or Springsteen or, you know, and I use them because they make sense to me, and I have a guitar and I can play it on my own. But, and I look up to them in some ways for what they've done, you know, but they're all my songs, which is what I'm really proud of. And none of them, they didn't write any of them.
Deep in the belly.
Do you see yourself more as a folk singer, more as a rock and roller, or do those distinctions even matter to you?
Every time I get in a cab and we start talking about music, I usually end up lying, saying I play like post-punk Mexican border music or something like that. I always try and do it, but I usually just say that it's rock and roll with lots of words. That's what I...
the I'm best of both worlds,
my
right?
Own, my own genre. Yeah.
You have emerged just recently. I mean, you are, you know, you're big. And I'm wondering if that must be fun, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
I've never lived the life of a rock and roll star, so I don't know what that's like. I mean, do you have a posse? Is it sort of hard to figure out how to keep your head?
It's fun. I will say, like, over the last, you know, it's way different than I thought it would be, you know. I started playing open mics when I was 22 in the Boston area. I moved out from Idaho to Ohio and then to Boston. And then it's kind of, so I've been touring for a long time, and only now have I noticed that there's certain things that get easier and they allow you to work harder on the things that make you do what you do if you can not be distracted by all the other things that come along. The other thing I've noticed is that people tell you where to go a lot more, you know?
Really? Like, I would think you'd be now telling them where to go.
No, I thought that would be the case, but unfortunately not. And the other thing I noticed is that there's a lot more sandwiches involved in my day than I'm comfortable with. When I go home, I'm just going to have like a sandwich-free month, you know.
So that what that really means is then when you're off tour, you go home, I guess that must mean that much more. I mean, when you have your own space.
Oh yeah, it's shaky for a couple of days there without the tour manager, but it's great. You know, really, like, the best thing in the world, the thing that I find the best about being home after being on a tour for a long period is that I get up in the morning and make coffee in my own kitchen. And I also found that I love washing dishes. You know, my cooking is getting a little better, but not much better. And I really just like washing dishes. I don't know what it is, but I can't figure that out. It's Freudian.
Once I knew a girl in the hard, hard times. She made me a shirt out of fives and dimes. Now she's gone, but when I wear it, she crosses my mind. And if the best is for the best, then the best is unkind. I realize that Illinois.
Steve Paulson spoke with folk rocker Josh Ritter in the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio in Madison. Ritter's latest album is called The Historical Conquests of Josh Ritter. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like to comment on what you've heard, we'd love to hear from you. Send us email through our website at ttbook.org. You can buy a CD of the show by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. So You Want to Be a Rock Star, program number 727A. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This program was produced by Veronica Rickert, Ann Strangechamps, Mary Lou Finnegan, Charles Monroe Kane, and Doug Gordon. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast.
PRI, Public Radio International.